You're listening to Preserves, a Manitoba food history podcast, exploring the rich, flavorful history of Manitoba food and the people who make it, sell it, and eat it. From the packing table to the dinner table, from restaurant specials to grandma's secret recipes, we consider the cultural, social, and commercial aspects of Manitoba food and what it means to us. I'm your host, Ken Davies. As per usual, I'm joined by Manitoba historian, Professor Janice Thiessen.
Hi, Kent. What's in the pantry for us today?
Today we're doing another episode featuring podcasts from students in your recent food history class, Breanne Mysak and Emma Dubisky. First up, Breanne's podcast focuses on the idea of unskilled labor versus skilled labor in the workforce and misconceptions surrounding what unskilled labor actually is.
Yes, and it features an interview I did with John Caligaris, owner of Winnipeg staple VJ's Drive-In.
Oh, I love VJ's.
Yes, it is a personal favorite of mine. And one of our earliest podcasts, you may remember, was about the history of the Fat Boy, a classic burger that is the essential menu item of Greek-Canadian restaurants in Manitoba. And hot take, there is no better Fat Boy in this province, in my opinion, than the VJ's special. Part of it is the atmosphere of the place. VJ's is a tiny but spotless venue. Strictly takeout. You stand in line, your order is memorized rather than written down by the cooks. And if you're lucky, you get a chance to meet John, who is known for his rapid speech, his love of his father, and his commitment to his restaurant. And the burger itself features a Greek chili sauce and mayonnaise in perfect, not too drippy proportions, a handmade hamburger patty, pickles and tomatoes and shredded lettuce all held together in a locally made bun. Thanks, Kent. Now I'm hungry.
Yeah, me too. I love VJ's, and Caligaris is such a great Winnipeg character. Everybody knows him, and I'm really excited to hear what he has to say.
Yes, let's listen.
But skilled and unskilled, I don't agree with that. That in some ways is very unfair.
For sure.
It puts him at, like, it makes it sound like what, he's sitting in the corner with a dunce cap on. No, I can't agree with that. I can't. I'm a professional restaurateur. Some people might think I'm a burger flipper. You know what? You want to have that mentality, go right ahead. So yeah, you just brush those off, because you'll have that everywhere and anywhere. That never goes away, my dear, unfortunately.
That was John Caligaris, owner of Winnipeg's very own VJ's Drive-In. As someone who's been involved in the hospitality industry since I was just 15 years old, I feel like I have heard and seen it all, as some would say. For as long as I can remember, the conversation regarding skilled versus unskilled work has been controversial. The question is, has work in the hospitality industry always been considered unskilled? And if so, why? Historically, the categories of skilled versus unskilled in the workforce were used to determine the amount of time and training that went into a job. Traditionally, skilled workers were considered to have significant training and expertise in a specific field. In other words, these would be jobs that one would typically have to go back to school for after high school. For example, electricians, plumbers, carpenters. Unskilled workers, on the other hand, tend to lack training and skill. According to historian Peter Burns, unskilled jobs are those that people naturally know how to do, and he uses cleaners, grocery clerks, and cooks as examples. The concepts of skilled and unskilled labor prevalent today are mostly derived from the Western industrial culture of the late 1800s and early 1900s. This period was marked by a period of social stratification, in other words, social hierarchy, and because white-collar jobs became increasingly important for industrial capitalism, they quickly gained much greater respect. And this was simply due to their requirement of a high school diploma and the salary rather than the hourly wage. This concept of skilled and unskilled also developed during a period where women were grossly devalued in a male-dominated society, giving rise to socially constructed notions of skill, which allowed managers more control over the workforce. This hierarchy also gave companies a reason to severely underpay their employees, specifically women. Employers have tried to minimize the costs associated with hiring workers in labor-intensive industries since the 18th century, by defining most jobs as unskilled or low-skilled. According to Burns, because women in most societies are presumed to be naturally capable at cleaning, washing, cooking, and serving, and since the hospitality industry needs precisely those jobs done, employers figured they could keep their labor costs low if they could define these jobs as women's work. Men were, however, expected to utilize their talents and masculinity for more skilled, valuable positions. So to me, this is extremely interesting because it provides evidence that the classification of the labor force into skilled and unskilled may actually have a lot more to do with factors of societal perception rather than the actual tasks performed at work. In other words, a social construct. But honestly, just because these jobs don't bring in a six-figure salary or require a degree does not mean there's a lack of skill involved in these positions. Moreover, the skills involved in hospitality are just as valuable as those possessed by someone with a degree. For instance, think about a dish in a restaurant that has 18 components on the plate. Occasionally, these components are pricey ingredients that have been fermented, dehydrated, smoked, disassembled, reassembled, and delivered to a plate via tweezers. This is an art. We wouldn't devalue the art of a photographer, or a graphic designer, or an artist. So why is it that people feel they can devalue the art of the work in hospitality? There is also a significant amount of mental, physical, and emotional labor involved in hospitality too. However, this is often ignored. Working in such an environment requires more than an ability to operate a cash register, take orders, and deliver food. Emotional demands are made of employees to constantly be in a positive, joyful, and even playful mood, despite how they may really be feeling. Customer service staff are constantly required to manage their emotions and put on a smile for the benefit of the customer and essentially business. This is literally an expectation of the job. For example, dealing with an angry customer, you might feel angry too and want to naturally react, but you have to restrain these emotions and display only the correct ones, not only to effectively de-escalate the situation, but to make the customer happy. And this in itself is a skill. And speaking from experience, it's not always an easy one. There are many other circumstances when service staff, specifically women, are expected to put their feelings aside, but also their safety, to meet a customer's service expectations, such as suggestive jokes, unwanted bodily contact, and so on. This is not just a recent phenomenon either. These issues have existed in the hospitality industry for as long as they've been operating. For example, in 1940 at Civil's, which was a drive-in restaurant in Houston, applicants were expected to be between 18 and 25, have a good figure, and a come-hither personality. In other words, flirtatious and sexually inviting. Now, I've had the opportunity to work and train many staff over the years in my hospitality career. But there is no amount of training that can prepare someone to be a people person. Moreover, have the patience and skill it requires to deal with some of the people and situations you encounter on a daily basis. You either got it or you don't. And because this is such a huge quality of the job in hospitality, simply means not everyone's cut out for it, regardless of how educated or skilled you might be.
I've had kids there that went to university. The one in particular, and she couldn't even do simple mathematics. 70 cents for coffee, she couldn't give out the change. I'm like, you're not cut out for this, honey.
The physical labor is evident. Whether you are front house staff or back house, you are required to be on your feet for very long periods of time, sometimes without breaks. And I can speak on this from experience. There were nights I would work a 10-hour shift without a single break because it was just too busy to take one. Or the countless nights that you were expecting to be off at a certain time, but because it was so busy, you end up having to pull a double shift, or you don't get home until 3 a.m. because it takes that long to clean up after close, and then have to be back at 9 a.m. This can be extremely physically, mentally, and emotionally exhausting in itself.
I think it takes no effort. Oh, it takes a lot of effort, Jonas. It takes a lot of effort. People don't understand. They don't see that. Their lights were on last night. Why were they on last night at 3 in the morning? Because I was still there. What do you mean? What were you doing there at 3 in the morning? Doing my work. Oh. And sometimes I don't stop all night. My break is after when I close. I sit down for half an hour, an hour, have a coffee, and just sit there.
In addition to the excessive workload, you are required to do constant lifting and carrying. Not only just dishes and trays, but if you're working by yourself and a keg of beer needs to be changed, for example, well, you can only guess who's changing it. And just for reference, those are roughly 150 pounds. When food and liquor shipments are delivered, they're only delivered to a certain point within the establishment, which is typically the back door. And then it's in the staff's hands to take over. And again, these are not exactly light items. The low skills argument also tends to neglect the opportunities that hospitality provides for the relatively easy access to entrepreneurial and management skills. Although you may start out in a low-wage, low-skill position, as Burns would say, these establishments, unlike some others, always have opportunities to move up. For example, at the start of my hospitality career, I typically started out as serving staff or even hostess. However, over time, I would move up to bartender and then eventually shift leader, then manager. Eventually, towards the end of my career, I was getting offered new opportunities starting in management positions because of all the prior experience and skill I have. And this applies to all levels of hospitality, fast food, casual dining, and fine dining. However, one thing I have noticed is, depending on where you work, your title and level of respect may change. Between fast food, casual dining, and fine dining, it almost seems like the classier the establishment, the more skilled and respected the staff are believed to be. So why is this?
I'd like a large coffee.
When the very first drive-in restaurant, also known as Car Hops, opened in 1921 in Dallas, Texas, the fast food restaurant was quite different than what we see now. What started out as a drive-up order from a limited menu and eat in your vehicle eventually evolved to what we see now. Fast food as we know it today is commonly known to be quick, affordable, and convenient, with a wide variety of menu items that consist of burgers and a number of other deep-fried goods. The staff, or burger flippers, as many would call them, typically work in a fast-paced assembly line, preparing and cooking the fast, easy, and affordable food. So the places we would be familiar with is like McDonald's, Burger King, Wendy's, VJ's, and Junior's. Throughout history, flipping burgers has been considered a low-wage, low-skill job, with very little opportunity to advance. And because of this, the idea of burger flipping became a potent symbol to those that worried the U.S. economy was increasingly creating more and more jobs with diminished prospects for advancement. We have casual dining, which would be more a sit-in restaurant, so like Boston Pizza, Sorrento's, Montana's, where prices are reasonable, quality service is given, good food, typically bar food, so appetizers, pizzas, pastas, and so on, but in a more casual, kid-friendly environment, so bright lights and loud music. It is believed that in casual dining, the quality of foods and services should be above a certain standard, at least better than fast food restaurants, but the food should not cost as much as fine dining. In Winnipeg, fine dining would be more of a Keg or 529 Wellington's High Steakhouse. This is where you would expect to receive exceptional service from knowledgeable staff, quality food cooked by qualified chefs, often high-end steaks and seafood, and in a high-quality environment, so tablecloths, indirect lighting, and soft music. So the question is, why is it that if you're a cook in a fast food restaurant, you're considered a burger flipper? But if you're a cook in a fine dining restaurant, you're considered a skilled chef. There may be qualification differences. Fine dining may require some sort of culinary background. But who's to say these skills and others don't exist in other service establishments? They definitely do. These skills may just present themselves in different areas other than physically cooking, like customer service skills, for example. It is also a fact that because of the high demands of a chef and the lack of pay, many high-end chefs are actually leaving fine dining restaurants and choosing to work in a more casual establishment. Therefore, they are bringing their skills to these establishments, but it's because it's not a 4- or 5-star restaurant, their skills are no longer valued? Throughout history and still today, there has without a doubt been a divide between skilled versus unskilled labor and workers. Although the workers in the service industry continue to maintain their position as unskilled, there is significant amount of evidence that suggests there has been a shift from these ideas being based primarily on gender to now including class and/or economic status. Unfortunately, this is just how society has been trained to think, all throughout history and even now. The truth is, regardless of whether you work in fast food, casual dining, or fine dining, positions in hospitality require immense skill, and not always the kind that any culinary school or degree would offer you, but rather it is a learnt skill from experience that you would only get from working in the industry firsthand.
When I was in school, they never taught you anything about that. Well, shame on them. They should. Like you said, a literate or not a literate, there's some people that, you know, are supposedly educated and they have no clue, and yet the other ones that you say are, you know, the unskilled are the ones that didn't, and they have a basic understanding of how everything should be working, and they have it all in mind, all in order.
Yeah.
I learned all this stuff from the business. I never learned it in school. Percentages, amounts, this way, now way, all these things I learned firsthand from what I'm doing.
Yeah.
I thought, why isn't this in the schools? How are these kids supposed to be prepared? Do you know how to balance a checkbook? Do you know how to manage your finances? Do you know how to properly pay for your bills? Do you know how to set everything aside every month? Do you know how to set up a menu? I mean, for yourself.
Yeah.
I'm gonna eat this and this particular day. I'll make so much for these couple of days. And then, like they had the home ec classes, but people used to laugh at them. I thought they should have more of those. What if you're living with a family? Fine, if you're by yourself, maybe your parents passed away, maybe you don't have any parents. Who's gonna teach you how to cook? Who's gonna teach you how to do laundry? The basic things which people overlook, I find. I never learned that in school. But if it was there, I didn't see it. How's someone supposed to cook for themselves if they don't know?
That was great. I love it. No holds barred Caligaris. He brings up so many good points that are usually evident in reality shows like Undercover Boss, which exposes the power dynamics and how most of the time bosses that are in charge of something can't even do the thing themselves.
Yeah, it reminds me of the comments Canadian historian Ian MacKay once made at a conference. Something about how you or I might stand in front of a lump of coal and not think much of it. But a coal miner could look at it and think, ah, the craftsmanship of Glace Bay.
Yeah, true. Well, from questions of how we value labor, we now move to an alternative business structure, the cooperative. We'll be hearing Emma Dubeski's podcast on the history of the People's Cooperative Association in Winnipeg.
Yes, they were known for their incredible cream cheese, but even more so for their politics.
Yeah, and, you know, cooperatives are an important facet of Manitoba commerce and have played a significant role in our history. Today, cooperatives are still popular as a business model, with over 400 co-ops operating in the province, offering everything from childcare to hardware.
That's right, and Emma Dubeski tells us why that might be in this next podcast.
All right, let's give it a listen.
Ah, Winnipeg, the home of Folkfest, Festival du Voyageur, the Nutty Club, and communist milk? Yep, you heard that right. The world of milk in the early 20th century wasn't solely concerned with the delicious taste and avoiding catching tuberculosis. In fact, you could find out quite a bit about your neighbor's political affiliations by simply looking out the window and seeing which company was delivering their freshly bottled milk in the wee hours of the morning. My name's Emma Dubeski, and we're going to get into the nitty-gritty of the history of the People's Cooperative Association. Together, we'll unpack the role that the Ukrainian immigrant working class community in the north end of the city played in the creamery's establishment and later successes. As many Ukrainians began to immigrate to Canada in the late 19th and early 20th centuries, newcomers established block-type settlement patterns in both rural and urban settings. The north end of Winnipeg, also previously synonymous with the foreign quarter of the city, was one of those distinctive spatial divisions. Divided from the other areas of the city, and by proxy other ethnic groups, by urban infrastructure, the spatial segregation encouraged immigrant network building. Because of the low working-class wages, multiple families would end up sharing a home. As Jerry Zak, resident of the North End throughout the 30s, explains, his family shared a home with another Ukrainian family and a Polish family. The home had no bathtub, no insulation, hardly any heating, and the water was often frozen in the pipes throughout the winter. So, the conditions were desolate, but at least the community had each other for support. Because of the sizable Ukrainian immigrant community in the North End, newcomers rallied together to create significant religious and secular institutions for their ethnic group. As Slavic studies scholar Alexander Polosky notes, Ukrainian immigrants were typically noted to subscribe to radical socialist politics because many of them were exposed to or had been active participants in the radical, social, and national democratic parties in Ukraine. Those who weren't active in politics still possessed a level of working class consciousness from their previous work in the homeland. Cooperatives have been a staple for immigrants throughout Canada since the 19th century. Farm business columnist Laura Rance explains that many newcomers knew that with the exhausting work of hard agricultural labor and the desolate conditions in poor urban neighborhoods, survival depended on collective community effort. This form of grassroots capitalism combined with the spirit of socialist democracy meant that Ukrainians pooled together to get their own products into the market, contain price spikes, and create decent paying jobs. When you drive through the north end of Winnipeg today, you'll see murals which showcase different aspects of Ukrainian immigrant life, like Ukrainian newspapers and scenes of Ukrainian folk dancers. There's institutions like the Osaredok Ukrainian Cultural and Educational Center and the Blessed Virgin Mary Ukrainian Catholic Church. But the history of the People's Co-op begins with the Ukrainian Labor Temple. The Labor Temple served as a headquarters for Ukrainians in the North End, especially those rallying for the trade union movement in the 1919 Winnipeg General Strike. The temple provided different avenues for cultural expression and growth by means of education and art programs, their in-house printing press, and language classes. Most importantly, it was a political meeting space for the community of largely working-class folks. For the communist left and the nationalist right, the entire Ukrainian community could meet under one roof to bond and organize. The left-leaning figures in the temple wanted to create a cooperative which would sell coal and wood that would be collectively bought and sold at better prices for consumers. So, in September of 1928, the Workers and Farmers Cooperative Association, later renamed the People's Cooperative, was born. The co-op's overall goal was to, quote, demonstrate that working-class people and poor farmers could get together and challenge the way things were done in a capitalist society. Basically, they wanted to find a way for both the producers and consumers to reap the benefits of what they were producing. In 1931, the co-op was looking to expand their horizons beyond fuel and wood, so they turned to dairy production. You might be asking, why dairy? Well, that's because it was an industry that already had a stable market year-round, but was rapidly changing, and the co-op saw their chance for success. Most importantly, it was a way to bring new people into the world of class organizations while redirecting their economic interests into red political ones. What saved them during this period of uncertainty was the community who backed them. As historian Jim Muchaduk explains, the first generation of workers who had a dedicated belief that they could change capitalist society continued to buy shares, loan money, and, quote, work incredibly hard to assure the success and survival of this unique institution. So, how could milk be so contentious? After all, it's just something that North Americans typically drink alongside their breakfast. Wrong. The nationwide milk industry has been the center of political and economic debates since the late 19th century. For example, in Toronto, the often red-baited Toronto Housewives Association encouraged thousands of ordinary working-class women to reduce their dairy consumption and lobby for socialist policies for milk prices, regardless of whether or not they were radicals. For Winnipeg, the contention manifested in the price wars of the early 30s. This was a time where many farmers that had milk cows entered the bulk milk market to gain profit for whatever their other crops had lost in Depression-era price slashes. The large overproduction of milk meant that companies had to reduce prices paid to producers by 60% on top of gouging their prices for consumers. However, as manager John Sass explains, the co-op refused to let go of their mission.
I think the co-op probably could be noted one thing is keeping cheap prices of milk in the city, because all the other dairies knew you damn well better not raise the price because co-op won't go along with it. And then that's when they fought price controls and they said, let's have them. The other dairies wanted to go up and we would say no. The co-op would always do a presentation of the workers and the working people can't afford it. The government, give more support to the farmers. So they fought it on both ends.
In the 20s and 30s, before the dairy industry became so large, it was easy enough to discern which of your neighbors was a communist, or at least didn't mind supporting radicals, based on which horse was delivering their milk to their homes. Most people had milk and bread delivered to their homes daily. The bread industry was also one that was contentiously politicized, and most bakeries that were seen running their delivery routes were the small, family-owned, largely Ukrainian and Jewish businesses. An example being the Winnipeg Workers' Bakery, which fed the city during the general strike. But in the post-war years, things weren't always so black and white when it came to milk.
I think having that almost like a stigma sort of potentially could have hurt the growth of co-op in the early years, because people did feel that they were, you know, a communist type of organization, and they were, I guess, they were more afraid of them than anything. Mm-hmm. You know?
That was Arthur Gunn from Winnipeg's famous Gunn's Bakery. Understandably, those who didn't support leftist policies weren't as interested in buying the co-op's products. However, for others, as milk delivery man Murphy Dola explains, the very public support for workers and consumers was enticing enough.
I guess it made, must have made some mark on the milk. But if you're getting back to the working people, yes, there was a lot of loyalty for until the day that they left.
Most importantly, the co-op knew that their product's quality was even more influential than their politics. Arthur Gunn remembers the exceptional quality of the co-op's products, rendering them practically unbeatable within the larger market.
I do remember the drivers coming to the bakery and bringing the milk and the cheese and the cream cheese, products that were, in my estimation, unsurpassed anywhere that I'd seen. We used the cream cheese in our cheesecake, and it was just absolutely the best. It was always nice and smooth. It didn't have lumps or it just worked out really nice, and it was a wonderful, wonderful product.
These high-quality products, most notably their iconic cream cheese and high-quality butter, were truly the pride of the co-op, even winning them multiple awards and blue ribbons, which they made sure to publish in their canvassing handouts. They quickly ventured into producing buttermilk, sour cream, and cottage cheese, which appealed directly to their European immigrant customer base. Considering that the North End was largely a community of European working-class immigrants, the co-op knew that the quality of their delivery services was another key to their success. And as milkman Murphy Dola explains, his job was no easy feat.
What was your working day like when you first started?
We started about 4 o'clock in the morning, loading. It was very primitive. You ran to the houses and with your bottles of milk. I think we worked at that time 5 days a week, and it seemed like a nice, easy job, but nobody told me it was good. The winter time was coming.
Even though it was a different experience to deliver milk with vehicles rather than with a horse and buggy, it was nonetheless extremely challenging due to the long hours and physical labor. As a historical overview from the Manitoba government explains, until the 1950s, cows were milked by hand in the wee hours of the morning and had to undergo their subsequent processing, were then loaded onto buggies, and then distributed to customers' front steps, all by 7:30 a.m. While the job wasn't necessarily glamorous by any means, Dola explains that he and his co-workers felt much pride in their jobs as milk delivery men for the co-op. And a part of that job meant canvassing while delivering, or encouraging milk patrons to consider purchasing small shares to help keep the co-op running.
Canvassing was a part of my day each and every day. Yeah, I guess I was about the best one that they ever had there, because a couple of times I built it to capacity and then I give it away and built some more, and I always enjoyed it.
On top of their mandatory canvassing, in the earlier years of the co-op, the delivery men were hired on the basis of their language skills. Many of them, family of immigrants themselves, were able to communicate directly with the Ukrainians in the North End, who either had little English skills or just formed a closer connection through their mutual language and culture. It was another way to strengthen and maintain their customer base throughout the harder economic times. The success of the co-op couldn't withstand the rapidly growing milk market and the popularity of large chain stores like Safeway, Sobeys, and Piggly Wiggly. On top of the growing competition, it became harder to find young Ukrainian radicals in the 70s and 80s in comparison to the Depression and immediate post-war years. Economic upturn meant that many immigrants who were no longer facing financial difficulties were able to move out of the North End. Between 1951 to 61, nearly 10% of the Ukrainian population had dispersed, and that number was even more noticeable in the later decades of the century. Ultimately, this signaled a larger fragmentation of the previously segregated community. Financial crisis after financial crisis, the co-op eventually shut down in 1992 after they sold all of the shares back to their employees in a final act of altruism. The dissolution of the co-op left a cow-sized hole in the heart of the North End Ukrainian and working-class communities.
If someone came to me and told me, we're revitalizing co-op and we've got a few of these products available for sale, would you buy them? My answer would absolutely be, for sure, yes.
For many, the co-op left a lasting impression in terms of their product's quality, their constant political work to protect workers and consumers, and the community that they had built. In the words of historian Jim Mochirok, quote, as the new millennium unfolds, we need more institutions like the People's Co-op that can help to build communities and encourage people to think in alternative, cooperative ways. We will need these havens in a heartless world more than ever.
You've been listening to Preserves, a Manitoba food history podcast, hosted by myself, Kent Davies, and Janice Thiessen. This episode was written, narrated, and produced by Brianne Mysak and Emma Debesky, with some production help from myself, Kent Davies. Our theme music is by Robert Kenning. Preserves is recorded at the University of Winnipeg Oral History Center. You can check out the OHC and all the work that we do at oralhistorycenter.ca. For more Manitoba Food History Project content, information, and events, go to manitobafoodhistory.ca. We're also on Instagram and Facebook. If you have a Manitoba food story and you want to share it, contact us by clicking on the contact link on our website. Preserves is made possible from a research grant from the Social Sciences and Humanities Research Council of Canada. Thanks for listening.